Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm a tired Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. We're finally back. Finally.
Is it like the longest hiatus
you know
that
what?
We've ever
it seems
been
like,
on?
It seems like every show we say, hey, we're going to be shooting all the time now. And then we don't for like 6 months.
Right.
But we are back. And it's not that we don't want to do the show, but every week something comes up. I know we have a few weeks ahead of us where we have live events we're not going to be able to shoot, but we'll see if we can wiggle it in somewhere else. So what's been going on? We had Build. I was out for Build, and then I was
out
Build
for...
Build was phenomenal, but it was it took a lot out of us. So there is a lot going on.
I heard it was like one of the more information-packed builds out there.
It was, yeah. So we shot 200 videos, or when I say we, I mean Golnaz. But we shot like 200 videos for Build in advance, which we did that. And then we shot, I don't know, what was it, like 30 of them or something live. So it was, you know, we're a small team. And so that kind of event, it takes a lot of planning. But got through that. And then we did the Edge Web Summit right after that. We did a bunch of other events. I went to, I was in Dublin, was it last week, I think? Yeah, last week I was in Dublin. We did the Decoded event there. I was walking around the streets of Dublin, and I saw this sticker that you can put up. Do you have it?
You didn't send it to me, dude.
I sent it to you.
Didn't send it to me.
You have it in your email. If you look at your email, you're going to find it. So, yeah, I was walking around the streets of Dublin in the middle of the night, and I look up and I see this. There is a club devoted to you. So
I really got to wonder what goes on in that club.
I know. And I did a search because I was like, I better make sure that it's not like some S&M club or something. And I'm promoting it here on the show. That would
but you
be
couldn't
awesome.
Find anything for it.
Couldn't
eh?
Find anything. So you looked and maybe a band. I don't know.
Possibly a band. But yeah, I couldn't find anything with that exact.
I'm going to stick with it's a club devoted to you.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's a nice logo, so it, I like it.
It's, what is that, put your fingers in your ears, close your eyes, la, 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 la.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know what it is. So yeah, we're very excited to shoot. Came in, and Mark Rusinovich showed up, too.
Very
so,
cool.
What was he talking about? There's something new?
Yeah, he produced a new tool called Sysmon. Which is actually a really cool method to monitor your system. It installs a kernel mode driver and a service that can log system events for mm-hmm. Interesting activities like process creations. You can apparently record like MD5 hashes or, you know, probably better, SHA-256 hashes of image files. You can see, you know, make sure that the files that you're running are actually valid. And that they're known. It was actually pretty cool, cool way of monitoring your system for anything that's out of the ordinary that would not necessarily be caught by AV or malware detection. But if you also want to use it for performance, you'd see, you know, what's running that may be taking away cycles from your system. Just a good method of inspecting your system.
Very cool. Nice. And then the last thing is, while I was in Ireland, I saw that a video went up, Defrag Show Crossover, where Andrew and Chad went and met with the Defrag Show team. You.
Not quite team, huh?
No, I was, and I thought, wow, I thought I was part of that team, and I didn't see any cameras where I was, so.
Yeah, I don't know if it was, specifically for team or specifically on just talking to a developer
okay.
in Windows.
They were there anyway,
right.
So they showed up. All right, and then the comments there, it says, speaking of Defrag Show, when are we going to get another episode? Right now.
Right now.
Or not right now, but when you see this, but it will be this recording right now when you see
in
it.
In the future.
In the future.
Which will be
point.
Your present.
Yeah.
But it'll and, be our past.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, that's cool. Awesome. Go check that out. Defrag Tool Show, episode 162. Ready for questions?
Indeed.
Let's get started. I ran Netstat on my computer and found a huge number of remote IPs are connected, at least one of which shows as being from a website which, when I searched, was listed as a known scam site, a site I've never been to myself. What I'd like to be able to do is kick off all outside connections right now and work out a way to filter and monitor connections so it doesn't happen again?
I actually really like this question because it really wanted me to think about how to solve this a little bit more holistically.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about the types of dangers out there that people may not be knowing about.
Define what connected to means.
So the netstat command, and I actually have a slightly modified version of that command here, netstat-a-n-o, which will also tell you about the process that is listening.
Okay.
Which is actually really handy.
Yeah.
To know, you know, what is it that is actually connecting to that service.
So your webcam is hooked up to some foreign
exactly.
site.
Exactly. Well, yeah, so it could be your webcam if it has a process, like a service that is connecting to, you know, anything on the internet. You'll be able to see that, and you'd be able to kill those connections or kill those processes. But it's actually kind of interesting because he's talked about a known scam site, but he has never visited it directly.
Yeah.
He doesn't actually have to visit anything directly because
yeah.
it can actually be an embedded iframe or an ad in another website, right? You don't ever actually have to go to a site directly to be directed to multiple
transparent
different
IPs. Pixel or
exactly.
Who knows what.
Exactly. There's tons of different ways that you could be connected to an outside source.
Yeah.
Just your web browser, a service, your tray icon, your tray icon is a misnomer, and something that is a resident application in your notification area.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the proper term for it. But anyways, you can take a look by using this netstat-a-n-o to take a look at the various connections that are connected to your machine and there are processes that are linked with it. So for example, I've got some connections here and, you know, 15.0.64 is one of the PIDs that is linked to it. And that, well, at that point in time anyways, let's take a look at, let's do that again and see what's current here. So say 22.64, which is established. You just sort
Internet Explorer. I mean, not Internet Explorer, Windows Explorer.
Explorer, exactly. So this could be anything like a shell extension that's running.
Mm-hmm.
It could be.
Why would a shell extension connect to an external IP address?
Potentially for telemetry reasons. You know, it sent a log or an event that said, hey, this particular thing got hit in code, and they're sending telemetry about it.
Yeah.
Could be any number of reasons. You'd have to actually dig and figure out what these IPs are. And there's a graphical view of this type of thing off of SysInternals, another SysInternals tool called TCPView, which does something very similar, but the nice thing about this one is it can show things in real time. So it can show things as they're being established and torn down, which is what you might see out of something like a botnet where it is connected to multiple different things very rapidly, changing itself to hide itself. And as part of the question, how could they filter something like that or prevent those types of connections? You can set policies using the advanced firewall configuration in your incoming block list. So if you go, for example, and type firewall, you can actually change your inbound rules. Now I have a ton of inbound rules here. Create a new one and you can put those IPs into this filter list and it'll simply block that connection coming into your machine. Or you can add it also to your outbound rules and it'll block that connection if it's an outbound connection to that system. Now, I tend to find that working within the single machine firewall, it just doesn't scale all that well. So you can buy routers that have firewalls that can you tweak the rules within them. I tend to like those. You can buy separate firewall appliances they tend to be significantly pricier because they're usually for small business or for enterprises. Mm-hmm. Never really found a really, really good one for home use.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've built up, you know, different Windows boxes or Linux boxes or whatever to act as firewalls under IP chains under Linux or the old internet configuration, internet, the old ICF firewall in Windows Server. But yeah, those are basically your options on filtering and protecting yourself if you don't want to install the third-party software, you know, malware detection and AV software. But I tend to find those as being more problematic than useful as opposed to just going the hardware route and getting known good block lists off the net and just adding those. Because those are the ones that are vetted across a whole bunch of different organizations, enterprise uses them, and they're really, really good at filtering that way. One other thing you can do is change your DNS server. I think I talked about this in the past, using the Pi hole. You can get a Raspberry Pi, and you like that name, don't you?
I just like to chuckle when you say that.
The Pi hole. You can get a Raspberry Pi or a Linux device, and that's good for blocking DNS lookups. But there's also OpenDNS, which is a third-party DNS solution that works really well for blocking those known scam sites. But again, only if it's a known name to an IP address.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Mark Rusinovich, for yet another tool we can use for that kind of stuff. All right, next question. I know this is backwards, but after spending half a day doing a clean install of Windows and updating drivers, I prefer not to have to repeat the process. I'd like to simply partition my SSD in half. Can I do this properly after having already installed Windows? Is there a recommended no malware third-party app that can accomplish this?
First, I'll say yes, you can do this. Just with the built-in tools, if you go to the disk management utility under computer management. If you have a recovery partition at the end of the drive, that is possibly going to screw you up because resizing doesn't really work that well.
Yeah.
But you can just click on this and choose shrink volume, and that will first shrink the volume. As there's free space, you might have to defrag it first. And then you'll be able to create additional space from there. Although, I don't personally tend to like to repartition the drive. You know, you've installed the system, you have all the latest drivers, however you installed them, just take a backup of the system.
Yeah. SSDs hard drives are already small and partitioned.
Generally speaking, yeah.
I'd rather just leave all the space on one, but everyone's different. Who knows?
Right. I mean, I just would tend to take an external USB 3 driver or a network driver or something and just create a full system backup. And just do that periodically.
Okay, cool. From Magic Andre, he says, what is update KB3152599 doing? The KB site is not online yet.
KB?
3152599.
So that KB is actually live now, and it just looks like a pretty basic update. When you update to 1511 or 10586 or the November update. It says that there's a race condition for some pre-installed applications, and this is simply a fix for that.
Okay.
So I'm not too sure if it was ever hidden or anything like that before or why it was not previously available, but it is available now, and it's nothing all that special.
Go get it, Magic. All right, next question from Martin. I have a slight problem with my Windows 10, and when I hibernate, it hibernates and automatically turns back on almost straight away. I've been working for a while, and I'm wondering if you could do a show on troubleshooting hibernation sometime. I did watch the PowerFig episode that was on Defrag Tools, and one command you showed there to get the reason for the last reboot didn't get me the information. It would have helped. I have a feeling that I've changed some wake on LAN functionality somewhere, either in BIOS or in Windows, but I'm not sure and I can't remember. Chad seemed to think that maybe it was something with the BIOS that was causing the issue. So he said you should update it if you can. What are your thoughts?
It's pretty hard to tell exactly what it would be that is happening, because is your system actually fully shutting down and then coming right back up again?
Yeah.
Or is, you know, the fan still running and it never shuts down and it comes back up? You can have third-party drivers that are going to veto the hibernation, although it is pretty odd for that to happen. Mm-hmm. If the system can sleep, usually it can hibernate. Mm-hmm. If you have changed some strain settings in the BIOS for ACPI power management, yep, that could have something to do with it. It's unlikely to be wake on LAN, especially if you are not on wired.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on a desktop that's not actually plugged in with the Ethernet, wake on LAN isn't ever going to do anything, because wake on LAN doesn't apply to wireless. Mm-hmm. I would also check to see if you have anything plugged into the system via USB, Thunderbolt, eSATA, any of those types of connections that may be causing some weird vetoing on the PCI bus.
So I've had some problems at home on desktop machines that I've built myself, where mm-hmm. I go to put them to sleep, mm-hmm. and it will act like it's asleep, but the fans still run. Mm-hmm. On the machine. Windows starts so fast now that I just shut it down all the time. I never do sleep. You know what that might be from?
While your fans are still running?
Yeah.
Your CPU could actually still be hot.
Oh, okay. No, that would make sense.
Right.
I don't think I've ever let it sit there long enough to let it would cool down to turn off. I usually just go, why are the fans still running? Then mm-hmm. turn it back on, shut it down.
I mean, are you overclocking on the system?
Yeah. Sometimes. Okay. All right. Next question. How do I configure Windows 10 so it displays a confirmation dialog every time I press a shutdown? Sometimes I would shut down my computer accidentally as the sleep button is just above the shutdown button and lose my unsaved work.
There is no way to configure a confirmation on that. There is, however, group policies that you can do to completely turn that off.
You got a workaround that would make me crawl out of my skin, but go ahead, talk about that.
Of shutting down the system?
Well, getting rid of the shutdown. So, like, what would you have to do? You'd have to Control-Alt-Delete and shut down from there? Or hold down the power button?
Oh, no, never hold down the power button. I mean, if you hit the power button, Windows will ask you, do you wish to shut down? And you can say yes. There's also command line utility shut down, and I go through interactive. I mean, this one is really like hardcore, because you have to add your computer name, and then you can choose what you would like to do here, and then yes, you know, you can warn users of the action.
That's the ultimate confirmation. There
that is
go.
The ultimate confirmation. You could always create this. I suppose you could always create an icon on the desktop that's a shortcut to this that is not the interactive. And then warn users of the action.
And then you and I both turn our keys at the same time and the machine finally shuts down. That's awesome. So no, there's not really a way to just ask it to confirm.
No, because, I mean, generally speaking, we tell users don't even bother shutting down.
Yeah.
Right? It's just close it, or if you're a desktop, leave it alone, it'll go to sleep, it'll go to hibernate on its mm-hmm. own. You know, if you're a laptop, I don't think I've ever shut down this thing, like,
yeah.
ever.
Yeah.
I've rebooted it and I've hibernated it. I don't think I've ever shut it down.
Okay, cool. Let's see, next question from Andre. Why is data duplication only supported in server editions? When capturing ETW traces with WPR, this generates NGen PDBs. When doing several traces in a row, this generates a lot of duplicated PDB files. Also, if you check out several branches of a project, there are also several duplicated files. It would be nice to activate the dedupe feature on developer systems.
Well, I think he kind of answered his own question there, because there is no end user that would ever need this, right? Dedupe is, quote unquote, a server feature. It's hard to say why we don't include certain features in all SKUs, mm-hmm. generally speaking, it's so that you can't run a client SKU as a server, right? Like, we have server SKUs because it has a particular workload. It is particularly tuned for that.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be nice if it was on desktop. You know, it'd also be nice to have multiple TS sessions into desktop. It'd be nice to have Hyper-V with GPU support on desktop, but we don't have that, like the remote FX.
Yeah,
we don't
but
have
we have
that.
Server.
But we have server.
So there's that.
Yeah, unless there is a significantly overriding business reason to get dedupe on client, there's just never gonna be that reason there.
Yeah, okay, next question. I was working on getting Skype working on a Windows 10 machine when I went to select a camera from the list in the video settings, and it read that my camera is already in use by another application. This occurs after restarting and installing updates. Is there anything in Windows 10 that would grab hold of the camera? This would be interesting tie-in with the IP addresses that are connected to my machine.
Well, I don't know if it'll help with the IP addresses, but is it a Logitech webcam, I wonder, because they tend to install a bunch of third-party applets that may start up when the system boots and grab the camera that way. So check again your notification area or check Task Manager and see if there's any apps that are even remotely related to the camera. You may also want to check the camera app itself. If it, for whatever reason, did a pre-launch start, check to see if it's running and, you know, kill that and see if that actually helps.
Okay. Next question. There's a bug in Windows 10 1511. XFAT shows wrong cluster size when someone tries to format. There's no K after the cluster size larger than 8192 bytes. Disk management is okay. PICs attached.
Yeah, this was actually specific to the Portuguese language. And we filed a bug on it, and it is on its way of being fixed.
Very cool. So glad we could help you out with that. Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let us know about bugs. Of course, the Windows feedback tool is going to be the better method because that will actually route to the correct team as opposed to trying to get it routed through me.
Yeah. It doesn't scale for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, next question. My fingers are usually clenched at my keyboard's home row, and it bugs me when I have to take my hands off to use the mouse to scroll. While the space bar gives a convenient option, it usually scrolls a full page. How do I change this? This is a great question, because I use the space bar to scroll all the time. Mm-hmm. Personally, I like that it scrolls a full page, because I can page through whatever I'm reading. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to change that, how would you do that?
It's per app.
So, really?
Yeah, the app itself has to take, like, it gets a notification of what a spacebar is.
Yeah, obviously, that makes sense.
Not everything scrolls by a page, right? Like, the desktop does not scroll by a page.
Yeah.
When you hit the spacebar, it's
even
a space.
Even like Windows Explorer, if you hit space, it wouldn't go to the next
That's
screen.
Right.
So, yeah, okay.
So, there's nothing that you can do as part of the OS that will change that. The app itself has to have a configuration to say,
so you could look in the settings of the browser. It's not likely.
It's not on the browser.
I've never seen that before. But
no.
Okay. All right. So possibly you can't. Next question from Robert. Do you guys know if there's an activation issue in the latest FastRing build 14.3.16? Installed it on my laptop. Now I have errors telling me that Windows cannot activate. When I run the troubleshooter, it tells me to install the Home Premium Edition Insider to activate it, but that's what I have. I'm assuming it thinks that it's Pro or other edition. If this is a build issue, will it most likely be resolved in a future build? If not, is there a way to resolve this issue?
Haven't heard of any activation issues, but what you can probably do is roll back and then try and get the update again. Make sure that when you roll back, you're still activated.
Yeah.
And then do another roll forward. To the latest flighted build.
Okay, cool. From Chris, it worked yesterday, but now when I try to open the Photos app, it just closes. If I try to open a JPEG with it, I get a window saying the remote procedural call failed. I'm running Windows 10 Pro Insider Preview build 14.295.rs1 release 160.318 16.28. So it might be a contributing factor, but I was running it yesterday too and Photos worked.
Move to the latest Insider build.
Okay. Also, one other thing that I did yesterday was play a couple levels of Unravel, scan my PC dock invoice, and upload to my internet with Chrome. And I did disk cleanup with Clean Manager and CC Cleaner.
Oy vey.
You weren't happy with that. You were like, no.
Yeah, folks know my opinion on that app. I'm not going to reiterate it.
Yeah, you know what's going through his head right now.
The best thing you can do is, again, roll back. You need to get back into a known state.
From Vidya, you spoke of a RAM disk. Any chance I could get the source code for that, or do you use some internal API that'll bring EU's anti-competitive wrath upon you?
No, there's no internal API or anything like that. There's lots of open source implementations for RAM disks. Larry will link to one that I have in the show notes.
Yep, Stack Overflow's got one. Quick question for you, because I saw this on, I think it was Reddit or something the other day. Someone was talking about in the old days, they would use a RAM doubler. And I remember because I worked at a VAR that used to build machines, mm-hmm. and they would have us install a RAM doubler mm-hmm. for our application. And mm-hmm. for whatever reason, it actually worked. Did that actually have benefit? Did those things work back in the day?
From what I recall about RAM doublers is it did some compression of memory.
Yeah.
So.
And I thought it almost had like a swap file thing on the hard drive too.
It did. And that's really all that it was.
Yeah.
Right? It was just another faster or another method of a swap file.
Yeah.
To get to more frequently used pages.
Okay.
But.
I was just wondering about that.
I haven't seen a RAM doubler since
the things we used to do.
Pre-Windows days.
Yeah. All right. Pre-Windows days.
Well, like pre-Windows 3.1.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Hey, Gove and Larry, love the show. Keep up the good work. I have a user that the Excel file takes several minutes to open. We're using Office 2013 32-bit, and the user gets the error. There isn't enough memory to complete this action. You need a RAM doubler. Sometimes when trying to open the file or manually calculate it on our Surface Pro 3 with 8 gig of RAM, the file is 13 meg, but it contains 86,000 rows, and they all need to be calculated. When opened, it takes around 900 meg of RAM. The files... is set to be manually calculated, but it still takes several minutes to be opened. I tried 64-bit Office, but it doesn't appear to be any faster. A file was a XLS, and I saved it to XLSX, but still not any faster. Is there any way to make it faster? Any tips you can give us for working with a large Excel sheet?
Yeah, I looked at that Excel file that they sent, and it was woefully inefficient.
Yeah.
It was essentially implementing a database within the Excel file, and they were doing multiple inner and outer joins within the Excel sheet doing calculations. It was completely CPU bound.
Yeah.
The best thing that they could ever do is just convert that into an actual relational database.
Yeah, okay. Pick of the week time. We're already towards the end of the show. Pick of the week. And the pick of the week this week is the Nokia Ozo. And I don't believe this is from the part of Nokia that Microsoft purchased, because I'm actually trying to get this camera and they won't return my emails. But
the at Microsoft.com.
No, it's not a Microsoft email. But this is a new VR camera. It appears to be probably the best VR camera that's out on the market right now. It does full 360-degree video, it has surround sound, and it'll do stereoscopic. So if you're looking with like an Oculus Rift or a Vive, mm-hmm. You can look around and see everything in 3D all the way around you. And so I am actually trying to get one of these, and if we can get our hands on one, we'd love to start doing some VR stuff on Channel 9. So it's in our roadmap going forward, and let us know if that's something you'd be interested in. I'm kind of curious how many of you guys have Vives or Oculus Rifts to begin with. And mm-hmm. And even if you don't have one of those devices, though, you could use just a web browser, and it'll let you pan around and see the shot. So, yeah, let us know what you think. But it is probably prohibitively expensive for the average person. Clocking in at a steep $60,000, but they'll take $15,000 off if you give them some feedback and shoot a video for them. Right. So,
I mean, the content producers, you know, are just one aspect, but as you say, the people that'll really benefit are the ones that are consuming it through the Rift and through HoloLens or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be really interesting to see this kind of thing like capture in a museum.
Yeah.
Right? So you can have even better virtual museums than they have now.
Mm-hmm.
just giving that access to new places, new experiences to people that wouldn't actually be able to go there.
Yeah.
You know, if they might just be too far away, or, you know, for accessibility reasons, you know, this kind of stuff just opens up a whole lot of new avenues.
Yeah. And the little device that you're looking at behind there is actually a combined battery and memory card that slides into the device. And so it powers it for about 45 minutes to an hour, and it'll shoot the same amount. The way that I think I would use it is it's got HDSDI out, and we just run it into our TriCaster. You can shoot, like, you know, portable video with it, you know, carry it around with you. They show it, you know, on a drone, which I don't think I it would kill me to put that on a drone and for me to know that I have about $70,000 up in the air at a given time. So, but if you have the tenacity to do that, more power to you. I would love to see the video from that. That'd be pretty cool.
I mean, if you have a drone that can lift that thing.
Yeah. I got a drone that would lift that, but I still wouldn't be comfortable doing it. Yeah. So there is that. Let us know what you think. If you want to see VR video on Channel 9, give us your feedback. And that is it. We're done. Are we back next week? I think. Maybe?
I think so.
All right. So we are wrapping up, and we will see you next week, or maybe the week after, but we will be back. We'll try to do the show more regularly.
Yep.
All right. Take care. Mm.